Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Kevin Calhoun, and it's my privilege today to be here. I'm a part of the appellant, Mr. Karan Porter. And I'd like to give just a brief background on this case. This is a felony murder case where the evidence showed that the defendant was eluding the police, got into an accident with the victim's vehicle, and the vehicle later died at the hospital. And the trial counsel filed a motion in limine to try to introduce evidence of gross medical negligence that occurred in the treatment of the victim at the hospital. And the trial court denied that request. And one of the reasons that it denied that request is because there's no authority in Virginia on whether gross medical negligence can break the causal connection in felony murder. And so we are here today asking the court to create some kind of rule or some kind of test in regards to gross medical negligence and its effect on the causal connection in felony murder. And I agree with the Assistant Attorney General in this case that one of the main issues is whether the evidence that was presented at the trial is relevant to a defense to felony murder, and specifically to the issue of a causation defense in felony murder. But as I was preparing this case, it appears that there's few, if any, cases in Virginia that really deal with what can break causal connection in a felony murder case.
How do you address your argument in light of Levinson?
Judge, I think that's a really good point. And I reviewed the Levinson case, and in that opinion, there's a reference to a Virginia Supreme Court case.
Jenkins.
Dorman versus State Industrial. It's a civil case, and there's a quote to that case, and it talks about the negligence intervening between the defendant's negligent act and the injury must be so entirely to supersede the operation of the defendant's negligence that it alone causes the injury. And so I think there's some room based on that quote for the court to determine or fashion some kind of rule that gross medical negligence can rise to that level, that it supersedes the defendant's action and essentially exempts the defendant from liability.
But counsel, doesn't that quote from Levinson, which is quoting the civil case, indicate that that needs to be almost a separate cause?
I think so. And I think the difficulty here is that there's just no rule in effect at this point. And so if this court's willing to draft a rule, I think the rule could say that this has to be a sole cause. It's got to be so grossly negligent that it is the cause of death. And then after that rule is perhaps created, then it would be our position that the case could be sent back down to the trial court for the trial court to perhaps determine, has that test been met? And if so, submit it to the jury to decide, well, is this a sole cause of the death, or is it just some contributing cause, which would be lesser than that?
Well, we do have some case law that says that basically if a defendant puts the action into motion, the Jenkins case is the one I'm thinking about, where the fellow had the gunshot wounds and then aspirated on his own vomit, and the defense argued unsuccessfully that, I think maybe successfully to us, and then unsuccessfully to the Supreme Court, that it was the aspiration of the vomit which couldn't have been foreseeable and under a negligence standard. And the court was pretty clear in saying if you put the action into motion, then you're responsible.
I understand. I think the way to distinguish that case from this case is there was no allegation of gross medical negligence in that case. I think there was no indication of any medical negligence in that case. It was just that the defendant started to, I think, choke on his own vomit after he had been shot. Whereas in this case, there is at least some evidence that there was negligence on the behalf of the doctors who were treating the victim.
But didn't the witnesses say in this case that we can't say that even if the doctor acted appropriately, he wouldn't have died?
There is. And I think that is an issue for the jury to determine whether the evidence has established if it's the sole cause of the victim's death or not. I think the testimony that Dr., I believe his name was Delaresco, had testified to is enough to at least get it to the jury. And I think that's kind of what the Commonwealth was arguing today, is that there's not enough. But I think there is enough that it's at least relevant. It makes some fact in the case more probable than not. And it has some tendency to make that fact more or less probable. And then once you've gotten past that step, it's for the jury to decide, is this a sole cause or is this just a contributing cause to the death?
There was no proffered of testimony that it would be the sole cause, was there?
I don't think those exact words came out of the doctor's mouth, but he did testify that this was a breach of the standard in care.
Sure.
And that he believed that if they had treated this particular issue, the heart issue, that the victim would have survived. I can't remember if he said through that night or he just would have survived. And so I think from that testimony, the jury could perhaps infer, well, the cause of death was the lack of the treatment of this particular issue.
But following up on what you're indicating in terms of a breach of the standard of care, you're talking about a civil determination in terms of usually malpractice suits. And that doesn't always involve gross negligence, but can involve someone who's just not met the standard of care and therefore are held to be liable. Mm-hmm. So where do we have a proffer following up on what Judge O'Brien asked as to anything that would even qualify to go before the jury as gross negligence, which is what you're inviting us to do in order to have it be a superseding event?
Yes, Judge. If I remember correctly, the Dr. Dell'Oresco testified when this victim came to the hospital. I think they did a CT scan, and they didn't notice anything. And then a couple hours later, they noticed some kind of heart issue, this pericardial infusion. They noticed that it had become significant, but then they still didn't do anything. And the Dr. Dell'Oresco testified that this is just a simple fix, essentially, that you stick either a tube or a needle in and drain the fluids. And they didn't do that, and then the victim died. But I think the most important part is that the, I can't remember if it was the doctor or trial counsel, proffered that there was a letter from the trauma surgeon that night that said, well, why didn't you tell me about this issue? And I think the court could have inferred from that that the lack in communicating to that was perhaps gross negligence, and that the trauma surgeon perhaps could have treated that issue if he would have known about it. And I think there is also other information.
Wasn't there other testimony, though, that given the considerable injuries that occurred to the decedent here, that he probably would have died anyway?
I think there was testimony to that effect, and I think that is, again, for the jury to consider. I think the Commonwealth, if this evidence would have come into the trial before the jury, could have cross-examined Dr. Dell'Oresco and got him to admit all those things to the jury and would have gone to the weight of his testimony. And the jury could have totally disbelieved what he had to say as to whether it was the cause of death or not, and stuck with what the medical examiner would have said. But I think the inverse is true, too.
But his testimony is, page 74 of the appendix, he agreed that the pericardial effusion was likely caused by blunt force trauma, which was the action that puts everything into play.
I agree, Judge, but I guess the position we're taking is gross medical negligence in failing to treat that cut off the liability of the defendant despite the fact that he put that into motion.
I guess circling back to my question about where is there evidence of gross negligence? I understand that you're saying this has to be something put before a jury. But for us to even consider it, doesn't there need to be a proffer or something indicating that it rises to a level higher than just the medical breaching the medical standard, which is a civil standard?
Yes, Judge. And I think perhaps the better thing trial counsel should have done was have the doctor testify that this is an outrageous breach of the standard of care, and I admit they didn't do that. But they did put some evidence in there to suggest that it could have been gross medical negligence, and there's also testimony that they went back and altered the records to show that there was this pericardial infusion when this person first came into the hospital and they didn't seem to catch it. So I think that could be relied on perhaps as an argument that this is gross medical negligence. And I just want to go back to this Levinson case, too. And in this case, if you look in the footnotes, there's two references to a case from Kansas State versus Kirby, and then a case from Michigan, People versus Bailey. And the Commonwealth addressed those in their brief. And if you read those cases in detail, in those cases, the in Kirby, the issue was whether the jury was given a meaningful opportunity to determine whether medical negligence was a superseding event, and the Supreme Court there found that the trial court issued an instruction that said if the proximate cause of the death resulted solely from erroneous treatment of physicians, you must acquit the defendant of any unlawful homicide. So I think the court is implicitly suggesting by referencing this case that it might be willing to consider arguments on this gross medical negligence and issue some kind of rule. And I think the same thing is true for this People v. Bailey case, which is the Supreme Court of Michigan. And that case is where someone initially assaults the victim, but there's a second person who assaults that same victim, and that particular person said that it was the second individual that probably caused the death. And they compared that case to a case where the defendant claims that his criminal liability should have been relieved as a result of the negligent medical treatment that was given at the hospital. And they said that in those cases, it's only where the evidence that medical treatment was grossly negligent that such treatment may be considered an intervening cause. So this is two cases that this court has cited to that has some standard by which the jury can determine, is the defendant's liability going to be cut off by gross medical negligence? So there is authority out there giving rise to this new rule. And I think it's important to point out, too, that the Commonwealth was aware that we're asking the court for a new rule and didn't come up with any kind of case, either in this Commonwealth or another state, that specifically says we've considered this issue on appeal and we're declining to follow that argument.
Couldn't, as one of the other judges, I believe it was Judge O'Brien, just said to you, in Levinson just last year, we said medical treatment is not a superseding cause if the need for the treatment was put into operation by the defendant's wrongful act or omission. So why can't that be that this court just consider that and rule the other way?
Yes, Judge. I think the distinguishing fact in that case is there's, again, no allegation of gross medical negligence in that case. I think perhaps this court is just considering ordinary medical negligence, whereas we're saying maybe there should be a rule on gross medical negligence, and if that cuts off the defendant's liability for any type of murder.
Okay. Counsel, you're in your rebuttal time. So.
Thank you.
Curry, good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, Liam Curry on behalf of the Commonwealth in this matter. I'd like to begin with just trying to shift the focus of the argument here. This arguments are being made about gross medical negligence, but what this case really comes down to is causation. Who caused this person's death? And whether gross medical negligence could have caused someone's death is not something that's just considered in a vacuum without any consideration of Virginia's prior case law. In Virginia, a defendant who wounds a victim is criminally responsible for that person's death if the victim dies directly or indirectly from those wounds through a chain of natural effects and causes. To that, going further, an intervening event, even if it does cause or contribute to that death, does not alleviate criminal liability for the defendant if that intervening act was put into operation by the defendant's own criminal actions. And only an independent superseding act that alone caused the victim's death, only that can extinguish criminal liability here. So the only consideration is not whether gross medical negligence could be a defense. That's not the consideration. The consideration for the trial court and for this court is whether there was a proffer of any evidence, any sort of conduct that was independent from the defendant's criminal actions that acted as the sole cause of the victim's death. The proffered testimony here in this case fails to meet that standard. There's, as some members of the panel had noted, there is no proffer that the victim's sole cause of death was medical treatment. In essence, that there's no evidence that the doctors did anything to kill the victim in this case. In the Levinson case, this court held that medical treatment is not a superseding cause if the need for medical treatment was put into operation by the defendant's wrongful acts or omissions. Levinson merely reinforces the ancient tradition that an intervening act must be the sole cause of death to cut off the defendant's criminal liability. In a footnote in Levinson, this court practically addresses squarely the argument that is before the court today when it cites to approval to the Bailey case from Michigan. The court quotes this language from Bailey: "A defendant cannot exonerate himself from criminal liability by showing that under a different or more skillful treatment, the doctor might have saved the life of the deceased and therefore have avoided the natural consequences flowing from the wounds." And that is exactly what Mr. Porter has attempted to do in the trial court and on this court on appeal. He is attempting to avoid the natural consequences for fatal wounds that he inflicted upon the victim. In the pretrial hearing, Mr. Porter proffered testimony from Dr. Doloresco, but that evidence was incapable of showing that the medical providers that treated to the victim, their actions, their alleged gross medical negligence was the sole cause of the victim's death. For this to be a jury issue, it would make sense that there would be perhaps a battle of the experts. Whose side do you believe? Who caused the victim's death here? The doctor's testimony was that the victim died of pericardial effusion and the failure to treat it. However, the doctor's proffered testimony was clear that he agreed with the conclusion of the medical examiner in this case that the official cause of death was blunt force trauma that the victim sustained in the car accident with the defendant. Dr. Doloresco testified that the blunt force trauma injuries that the defendant inflicted upon the victim were fatal, and that the victim would have died if those injuries had gone untreated. While the defendant's expert testified that the failure to treat the pericardial effusion was a breach of the standard of care, he also testified very candidly that the pericardial effusion was caused by the car accident that the defendant unquestionably caused while he was engaged in a felony of eluding from the police. And Dr. Doloresco also testified that the pericardial effusion was in no manner caused by the treating physicians for the victim. Finally, Dr. Doloresco testified that while he believed that the victim would have survived if the medical providers had treated the pericardial effusion earlier, he also concluded that he may not have survived if he had been treated in the manner that he deemed consistent with the standard of care. So in summary, Porter failed to present any evidence that would allow a jury to find that the gross medical negligence was the sole cause of the victim's death. In both the trial court and in this court, Porter is attempting to assert a defense to felony murder based upon proper evidence that the victim didn't receive the best conceivable medical care for injuries that the defendant himself inflicted upon the victim. This court should reject his attempt to escape criminal liability under such circumstances. For these reasons, I would ask this court to find that the trial court did not abuse its discretion when it excluded Dr. Doloresco's testimony from consideration by the jury because it was irrelevant to any recognized defense for homicide in Virginia. And if there are no questions from the panel, I would ask this court to affirm the judgment.
No questions.
Thank you, Mr. Kelvin.
Just
briefly, Your Honors, I think obviously Dr. Doloresco could have provided more information on the sole cause of death, but I suppose the real question is did he get just past the threshold of relevancy to a potential issue of causation that it should have been submitted to the jury? And it's our position that while he might not have gone much further past that baseline, that he did in fact go beyond the baseline for relevancy when he is testifying that this victim would have survived if they would have treated this specific injury, and that he thought that this was a breach of the standard of care. And so once you get past that, we're asking the court to create some kind of rule that the jury can use in determining, well, is this in fact the sole cause of death, or is this just a contributing cause? So unless you all have other questions, that's all I have.
Thank you, counsel. We'll come